separated this morning before they came to court and were led to believe that when they return to the detention facility, their children are going to be there. But we know that the children will not be there because the government is separating them.
So it may surprise some to know, Efren Olivares, that some 1,000 children are still separated at this point. I believe when the Biden administration came in, they put Dr. Jill Biden, President Biden's wife, the first lady, overall in charge of reunification. If you can talk about the effect, in the book, you also write about your own experience so many years ago being separated from your family.
Yes, I, you know, that interview that you played, it was before this crisis had made national news, and we were struggling to break through and make sure that the public knew what was really happening at the border. And one of the saddest things is that we will probably never know how many families were actually separated, given the government's intentional lack of record keeping. We will not know. Many families were separated and the children ended up at a shelter, but the shelter never knew that that child had been traveling with a family, with a parent or a father or a mother, because there was no record keeping. And if the children were too little to be able to explain that, we will never know truly how many children were separated. And the as far as the lifelong consequences of that, you know, there's been widespread reporting on the trauma that experience, the violent ripping apart and of a child from his or her mom or her dad. And, you know, just thinking of that audio that leaked, if that doesn't convey what this policy caused to children and to parents, it is still hard to understand how in this country in 2018 and ongoing, it was possible to see such a cruel violation of human rights against children.
And Efren Olivares, we're going to do a post-show interview with you, post online at democracynow.org, to hear about your own life experience, as you write about in your book, My Boy Will Die of Sorrow, a memoir of immigration from the front lines. Efren Olivares, Deputy Legal Director now at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Immigrant Justice Project. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stacey.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
You're slick, you investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse, you put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse, and that's how it's done, war after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting-edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language. You creeps of disguise. Yeah, disinformation. It's like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers. You gambler thieves. You profit on war. You think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done. Time after time. Country after country. And crime after crime. You pretend it's religion. Like there's no one to blame. For the dead and impoverished. In your little patriot game. Honey, that's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket.
And good morning, everybody. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio, coming at you out of Southeast Portland, live in the studio with a guest. in the studio. It's kind of good to have that going on a more regular basis. Good morning, Cody.
Good morning, Paul.
And now I can introduce you in a second here. So we're going to be talking about Resist U.S.-led war movement, which you are a part of, among other things. I'm just gonna kind of read a little bit of this from the program page. Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine is once again, as during the Cold War, drawn the geopolitical battle lines, forcing countries to choose sides and individuals, I might say. It's kind of dividing the left, among other things, in this country, that Ukraine war. And once again, the United States has positioned itself as the champion of democracy and the foe of evil in the world. But of course, it never was that simplistic, and it isn't now. In 1968, 1 month before he was assassinated, Dr. Martin Luther King, in his now famous Beyond Vietnam speech, and that's linked on the program page. If you haven't read that speech, you really should. Called the U.S. the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Since then, this nation has supported death squads and repressive regimes in Central America, helped overthrow numerous democratically elected governments, invaded or sent troops to a host of countries, continued to send arms to brutal dictatorships and oppressive regimes all across the world, and maintained the largest military on the planet with some 600 military bases. That's according to the Pentagon itself in 2013. Abroad, the famous, quote, peace dividend that was supposed to arrive with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the supposed end of the Cold War vanished with the war on drugs and the war on terror. And U.S. military spending just keeps going higher and higher. Despite the ravages of climate change that are only getting worse and the massive wealth inequality that consigns millions to lives of despair and desperation, there are no signs that the United States is ready to renounce its history of unilateral aggression and domination and embark on a path towards global cooperation. But there continues to be opposition around the planet to this projection of U.S. corporate and military power. Today's guest, who I have with me in the studio, Cody Urban, is a member of the Resist U.S.-led war movement, which unites many of these global campaigns and organizations. So once again, welcome to KBOO Studios.
Thanks. Good to be with y'all.
So that's something that I hadn't been on my radar. So maybe first of all, before we talk about that group and your work with them, I've seen you. You know, I remember in the pre-pandemic era, I used to run into you occasionally at the various, I don't know, pro-Palestinian and some of the Philippine activist groups in Portland events and protests. Tell us a little bit how you got into this. What sort of will be your history of activism?
Yeah, so I moved to the Pacific Northwest in, I think it was about 2010. I grew up in Massachusetts, and in high school I started to get involved with, I think first more food justice issue, and that started to lead me to issues around economic inequality and racism in the U.S. And when I got to the Northwest and was in college, I moved to Olympia. I was at Evergreen State College, and I was kind of witnessing what was happening, I guess, around me, not really taking part in it, but there was Occupy Wall Street, there was the Arab Spring, all of these events happening that I would kind of witness and started to try to understand, like, what was it that was tying all this together? What was it that was not just causing so much injustice around the world, but what was it that was bringing people together to actually, like, fight back? So I did a lot of thinking, a lot of observing. But it was only after 2014, after I graduated, it was actually during that summer of 2014 that things really started to shift in me. And I got this idea that I really had to do something. And because the two big, I guess, formative things that I witnessed happening that summer was Operation Protective Edge, so-called, by the Israeli military. Yes. Especially talking about what's happening right now in Gaza. This was back during, there was over 2,000 Palestinians who were just murdered by the Israeli forces. And I was watching this happen for the first time, and I just couldn't understand how something like this could be allowed to happen for so long. And also what happened during that summer was Michael Brown's murder and the Ferguson uprising and the kind of big start of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so those two things happening that summer after I graduated made me realize I had to do more than just observe. And so I guess a little more than a year later, I started getting involved in climate justice work to start off. My first action really ever that I took place in was right here in Portland when the Fenica, the Shell icebreaker ship, came in for repairs. And you had the Greenpeace activists hanging down off the St. John's Bridge and all of these people out there on kayaks. I got on a kayak myself. And I just felt this big thrill of being with people saying, like, just yelling, this is wrong. We have to do something. And then like a day later when it was still happening, I got the next big experience of us saying, again, this is wrong. But then we had to fight to defend that because the Coast Guard, the sheriff, all of them came up on their boats and started to arrest people. So my friend got arrested during that action. I eventually got more involved with climate justice organizing here in Portland. I helped with organizing different actions against oil terminals. I was arrested myself back in 2016 up in the Break Free actions outside the fossil fuel, the oil terminals in Anacortes. Mm-hmm. But it was while I was doing this climate justice activism that I got in touch with the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines. And that's when I learned about the combined issue of climate and environmental justice with militarization and U.S. imperialism and what the U.S. was doing to other countries that are locking them in like a neo-colonial status, and how it was indigenous peoples, it was peasants, it was workers who were at the forefront of the struggle against the climate crisis. And so I actually went to the Philippines in 2016 with PCHIRP, the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines. And I eventually went to Palestine about a few months after that. And so those two trips in 2016 to the Philippines, to Mindanao, to integrate with indigenous communities, in particular indigenous schools that were fighting to further land. Land rights and livelihood, and also going to Palestine and actually witnessing the Israeli occupation firsthand. You know, like I remember actually walking with first graders to school through a checkpoint while there were Israeli border police with M16s in all of our faces. And so starting in really 2017 is when I realized this is what I'm going to do. I have to do something, because I could see the relation that the U.S. had to all of these issues that I had seen growing up, from food justice in high school, all the way throughout the Black Lives Matter movement and the fight against white supremacy, to the fight against imperialism and climate crisis. It's all the same. And eventually I got involved with one organization that I'm still involved with, the International League of People's Struggle, and that got me to the point where those of us in the ILPS, the International League of People's Struggle, and other organizations worked to launch this other movement, this broad anti-war platform called the Resist U.S.-Led War Movement. I guess that's what we're still doing today.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about that International League of People's Struggles and kind of how that got started and stuff. But so who are some of the groups and movements, organizations involved in this Resist U.S.-Led War Movement?
Yeah, so the Resist U.S.-Led War Movement was started in 2017 by a conference hosted by the League and the International Women's Alliance. And just a brief background on the International League of People's Struggle. It's an anti-imperialist alliance of over 350 organizations in over 45 different countries. I think that it really holds the title of the world's largest anti-imperialist alliance, the one that like self-describes as that when you look at the numbers.
So just to give us a smattering of some of the types of groups, organizations involved in that?
I mean, the league organizes around what we call concerns, so areas of concern in, and they're listed out as like national sovereignty, economic and socioeconomic justice, workers' rights, peasants' rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, and all of these are ways to rally people around what's the root cause of those concerns. And really comes down to imperialism and primarily U.S. imperialism. And so you can think of almost any organization that is fighting for those concerns. We have those in the league. Mm-hmm. And so in 2017, the league, along with, again, the International Women's Alliance, which is another alliance that we work closely with, held a conference in Toronto called Solidarity and Fight Back. And this was a really significant conference because it was during Trump's first year in office. You know, there was all of the, I think that was the year that he like restarted massive airstrikes against Syria. He escalated more airstrikes around the world in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was the quote unquote mother of all bombs, as it was called, that he ordered dropped on the countryside in Afghanistan and like proudly showed it all over all these US TV channels. I mean, so this conference was really timely, and it brought together not just members of ILPS and IWA, but many different organizations from around the world to come and talk about shared issues fighting back against militarization. So we had delegates from the Philippines. There were delegates from the Congo talking about cobalt and uranium mining and how the mining areas are an excuse for more militarization there. You had Kurdish women fighters who were fighting for the liberation of their land come and talk about why, you know, all these different issues of like women's liberation, land struggles, the environment, and all of this kind of comes together. And at the end of that conference, we came up with a unity statement that put together all of the, I guess, discussion points, the different panels that were talked about, and the different calls to action people were put in. And that turned into the Resist US-Led War Manifesto. And so all the organizations that signed this after the conference said, we want to keep organizing. We want to keep doing stuff around this platform. And so it was from there that the Resist US-Led War Manifesto, with its two calls, Resist US-Led War and Fight for Just and Lasting Peace, became a network. It became an alliance. And so ever since then, we've been working to coordinate more across the world on those calls to action.
So before we get into, you know, sort of like the, you know, we just commemorated Hiroshima and Nagasaki days, August 6th and 8th, which was, you know, arguably sort of the start of the real sort of U.S. hegemony of global, you know, military power and control. Obviously never complete hegemony. That's why there was the Cold War, but the, you know, it kind of established the with a massive bang, the power, the might of the United States, specifically nuclear, sort of, and how that kind of set the stage for things. I'm going to talk about that, it came into mind the you know, this broad coalition. You know, there've been broad coalitions. I remember the first Gulf War, the second Gulf War. They're fairly large coalitions, and then they kind of devolved into the usual sort of sectarian bickering and divisions. Any ideas about how to, if that sort of thing is already happening, how to forestall that from happening?
Well, I think the most important thing for us in Resist US-Led War movement is that we know that war touches everyone. You know, if you're not being negatively impacted from it, it's because you're profiting from it. And so because of that, there's so much potential to build that unity if you keep that focus on the ways that this is impacting everyone. And also knowing that because this is everyone, this is international, and you can't have just a U.S. Anti-war movement. You can't have just a Canadian anti-war movement. You can't have just a Tanzanian anti-war movement. It really has to be global in scale. And it doesn't mean that everyone does the same kind of actions. It doesn't mean that everyone, you're going to have, I guess a good example is that, you know, we have this campaign that we've recently launched called Cut Ties with War Profiteers that's trying to focus on the different weapons companies. I guess if you say war profiteers, it can go for a number of different companies, even talking about Motorola and Monsanto and all the other companies that are profiting off of war because it's getting them the resources they want. But particularly when it comes to weapons companies, I mean, imagine there's going to be a proposed weapons sale, like Lockheed Martin weapons sale to the Philippines. You know, how much impact could we make if we actually have, there's a rally in Manila at the U.S. Embassy, and there's also rallies in cities across the U.S. at Lockheed Martin headquarters, but also phone bombing Congress to say, stop this, and look what's happening here at offices in the U.S., and look what's happening in the embassy in the Philippines. The people are demanding you stop this. And so that's a way that we in Resist try to build that unity of action when it comes to fighting back against these powers.
Mm-hmm. So this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Rowland. And I'm in the studio this morning. I have with me Cody Urban, who's with the Resist U.S.-led anti-war movement, which is what we're talking about. So I guess, on the left, the internationalism is a major, historically, you know, a major rallying cry. It's kind of had its day and faded. And so obviously you all are really focusing strongly on the internationalist component, which is kind of fallen off a lot of ways here in the United States, right? I mean, it seems like
some places.
Yeah.
It's more than it's not as strong as it should be.
So let's talk about we just had the commemorations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki days, and the rise of the nuclear industry, the nuclear bomb industry, had such massive consequences for the really development of the national security state, the massive increase in secrecy, and then this whole, you know, mutually assured destruction that it had such an influence on global geopolitics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so actually I'm going to read just some facts that are pretty terrifying facts about this. And I'm reading actually from a recent social media post that we did with Resist. So for folks listening, you can go to Resist US Led War on Instagram or Facebook. And we have a social media project called Weapons Watch, where we're trying to focus on all the different aspects of the war industry and exposing the actions of weapons companies. But so you can look at this recent post we did that talks a lot about the current state of nuclear weapons today, and it's particularly its effects on indigenous peoples. But, you know, today there's over 13,000 nuclear, like already made nuclear weapons in existence. Over 90% of those are held by the U.S. and Russia. But, you know, a bunch of those are stored. So, like, they're stored for potential use. But almost 4,000 of them are armed and ready to go. And about 2,000 of them are what you could call on, quote unquote, high alert. And I think one of the biggest reasons why there are so many on so-called high alert is you look at what's happening around Ukraine. And, of course, Ukraine is just the flashpoint for this bigger, more terrifying confrontation that the U.S. and Russia are clashing, dragging the world into. And I think, in particular, the recent expansion of NATO that's been taking part, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is the U.S.'s largest, like, led military alliance, which, by the way, when we say we're the resist U.S.-led war movement, it's all the different aspects that the U.S. is leading militarism around the world. So NATO itself, we consider an aspect of U.S.-led war. But the recent, most likely membership of Sweden and Finland, is bringing the possibility for more NATO nuclear bases to actually get closer and closer to Russia. And actually, if you look at what started to happen in 2014 when the U.S. started sending CIA operatives into Ukraine to try to change the system in their favor, and how the U.S. started dumping military aid towards the Ukrainian government as the civil war started there in 2014, and that, those missiles got closer and closer and closer to Russia's border. It's not to excuse the actions of Russia invading Ukraine, but it is to, I think, really expose the way that this is exactly what the U.S. wanted to happen. This is the perfect excuse for more nuclear weapons to be created. It's the perfect excuse for more any kind of weapons to be created. And so I think that if you look at the terrifying statistics of nuclear weapons today, we can't separate that from the actions of the U.S. and its military allies and what it's doing to foment more and more crisis as the U.S. is desperately trying to get back to what inevitably, I think it never will, which is the world's number one military superpower with the rise of Russia and China. Those desperate attempts are just going to get more and more dangerous for all of us, and we have to resist any way we can.
Indeed. And what better place than from the heart of the beast?
I know. The belly of the beast. I don't see any heart here.
I'm sorry. That's the proper expression. Anyway, so this is Wednesday Talk Radio. Once again, I'm the host, Paul Roland, and the other voice is Cody Urban from the Resist U.S.-led war movement. This is a call-in show. We're getting on close to halfway through. If you would like to join in the conversation with a question or comment, the number to do it is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Oh, I have the sound on my computer, which is inevitably going to create problems. So let me just take care of that right now. There we go. A click. Yes. Don't have some...
One click and all your problems are away. Yeah, if only right. It was that easy.
So... again, that's something I've talked a fair amount about on this program. That I've had a number of guests to kind of resist what I called on one show, the a la Chomsky, the manufacturing of consent, mm-hmm. which just seemed to go mm-hmm. into overdrive around this Ukraine war. It just seemed like a lot of people had just thrown their critical faculties out the window. It was quite astounding. And then this kind of false conflict, within people who otherwise are against, U.S., overweening, whatever the term is, a desire for dominance and power and control, and, the profiteering on the weapons contractors' part, which is happening clearly now, and. Just the madness of it all. It sometimes we really need to take a step back, and instead of since we're so used to all this kind of stuff just going on and on and on and on, that's just mm-hmm. sort of the way it is. It's like, to me, the idea you start talking about being a climate activist. To me, the idea that we do have, that movie Don't Look Up came out, and compared it to a comet, which I think is very
couldn't be
very
more timely
appropriate, and the idea that we've got this thing, this juggernaut has developed and is already with us, is already causing massive devastation, and we can't break through to some kind of international cooperation. And so I've been harping on the idea of really a global demilitarization as being one of the key points, and that seems to be one of the things your group is heading to. But just the idea that we can sort of just find ourselves in another war, which is diverting resources, which is adding more to the climate crisis, which is preventing any kind of international cooperation, It's just astounding to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, the whole don't look up paradigm thing. It has moved into the issue of militarism too now, and the threats of all out, like World War III. And I think I definitely see all the parallels you're seeing about the sort of paralysis that's been on here for, I guess, decades now when it comes to the climate crisis. It's wild to say decades when you think of like climate denial, but you know, what else is it? And I think that especially, like, you know, when it comes to the situation we're at now militarily, where the US and Russia, I mean, I would argue that the war in Ukraine is a war between the US and Russia, that the US is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian soldier. The instant that at any point,
and Russia too, let us
and
know.
Russia, exactly.
And I just saw a headline saying, and I don't know, I just glanced at it, but you know, Putin is totally willing to use nuclear weapons, and maybe as early as next spring.
And this is the issue where we need to say that, you know, I was in Spain, I was in Madrid back in, I guess it was late June. For the anti-NATO activities that happen yearly wherever the NATO summit
is held. That's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization,
yes.
For anybody who may not know.
Yeah, which is was a Cold War alliance. It was created, you know, by the U.S., predominantly by the U.S. after World War II, with the sole purpose, really, and they admitted this in their founding assembly, or founding summit, the sole purpose to combat Russia, the Soviet Union at the time. And after the fall of the Soviet Union and the rise of a fully, openly capitalist Russia.
So no peace dividend here and collapse of any dream of a real socialist country in
yeah.
Russia.
Yeah, and you know, despite NATO's founding, I guess, existential purpose, which is combating the Soviet Union, despite the fact that the Soviet Union was gone, not only did NATO remain, it grew. It started to sweep in all of these countries that it said it would never include. It said that we would not creep an inch or a mile east. And yet all these other countries it brought in. And you can actually look when the argument can be made, all these countries that were former Soviet bloc countries, so they have the right to join whatever alliance they want now. But you can look at the history, you can look at a lot of the founding documents when these countries joined NATO, and you can clearly see that there was a very specific class, like business class in these countries, that pushed to join. And you look at a lot of the protests that were happening of the common people in these countries, and you can see this was not a fully consensual spread of NATO. Brought up to today, fast forward to today, when you have a lot of people who have been in the past saying, you know, we need to stop this monstrosity of NATO. I think that when I was in Spain, I have to admit there was a fear that I felt that was kind of lurking in the back, because of how desperate the situation is right now, how like dangerously close to open warfare Europe feels now. And I say Europe because, let's be honest, like the Cold War was a hot war for the rest of the world, for the Global South. The Global South, the semi-colonial countries, have been in a state of war nonstop since before the start of the Cold War. And so now that war, the risk of war is coming to Europe, there is this almost this fear to be as militant as it was in the past. And I think that if we, as anti-war organizers, as anti-imperialist organizers, truly trust the people, we trust us, you know, the people of the world, to find the unity to effectively challenge the actions of our governments, we have to trust that, you know, no matter how dangerous this situation is between Russia and the U.S., and really getting more between China and the U.S., I think that's the much more dangerous situation at this point. We have to find the courage to trust our potential to unite. We have to find the courage to say that we can't trust an alliance like NATO to be the thing that keeps us safe. If anything, that is making us more unsafe. And I think the same thing comes from the climate crisis, because there can be this paralysis of apathy when we think of the prospect of ecological collapse. And, you know, the way I see it, it's like, actually, I think back to that movie, Don't Look Up. And I guess, I don't know if this is a spoiler alert, but at the end, I just remember they're at Thanksgiving and everyone's saying this, like, things they're thankful for. And one person, I don't remember who it is, one person says, I'm thankful that we tried. And I think that that's, if there's going to be ecological collapse, which I truly believe we can avert if we unite, you know, I want us to say, well, we tried. And I think that we are trying, and we have to never stop trying.
And exactly. And we have a caller, but hold on, Molly, just a second here, because I just want to quickly follow up on that. Look, the thought that's been going on through my mind for quite a while now is that we really haven't fully tried yet. And that's why this whole idea of a globe, I've been searching for, like, not the key to, you know, solve the whole problem, but like for, like, what are really the driving forces? What, you know, what really could, if we were to really devote fully to it, what really could actually have a chance of mitigating, slowing down, stopping this climate juggernaut? And to me, the military is central to starting the whole thing off, to keeping the whole thing going, to preventing us from working together. So anyway, global demilitarization, and this seems like our best shot, and it seems like there seems to be more people waking up to that. Anyway, on that note, let's hear what Molly has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, and thanks for your topic and your show. The thing that came to my mind, and this seems a perfect segue to what you just said and the previous person before you, first of all, we already have a war in Europe, and so of course the people are worried, and what they're doing in Ukraine is a gallant effort. However, to the other previous statements, we're not doing enough. And when I heard about this nuclear power plant being under, you know, it was actually bombed by who cares which side, the Russians and Ukraine. So anyway, I think it's the UN, pretty sure that the UN said we need to have somebody step in, take over this nuclear power plant, which might as well be a nuclear bomb if, you know, these crazy people don't take seriously the danger of that in the midst of their so-called war. Well, it is a war, but this to me was a bright light in all the darkness, because then I thought, well, as far as peace, you know, and we all know, and I, Oppenheimer and all the guys who came up with the bomb just said, you know, this should be the end to war, because a nuclear bomb will literally destroy everyone and everything on this planet. So it can't happen. So maybe this is the solution to the end of the war, that we can no longer have a war that has this kind of outcome. So when I heard that, you know, some other neutral country could step into the midst of a war and take over a dangerous spot like this, this seemed very hopeful to me. Of course, the climate change and everything is related to this. And I just want to end my comment here on KBOO with, I recently saw 13 Lives, which I highly recommend. It's on Prime. It's a Ron Howard film about the boys that were rescued in Thailand. It's just really fantastic. And it's very well done. And all I thought about during that film, well, not all I thought about, but I was brought to mind the, you know, Ukraine and the schools being bombed. And here you have everyone in the country rallying to save these 13 boys and their coach. And then everyone in the world, people came in, expert divers from around the world, volunteering, not being paid, to save 13 lives. And it just, so the human crazy, insane human being has a capacity for compassion as well as this capacity for total insanity. So we just need to draw on that. I think this something going into the nuclear power plant in Ukraine is a fantastic move to sanity in the midst of insanity.
Well, thank you for that. And I if anything gives me the heebie-jeebies, that situation with that nuclear power plant really gives me the heebie-jeebies. Anyway, so thanks for bringing that up. Thoughts,
thanks
Cody?
Thanks for your topic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the part where I always go back to the trust in the people, because I think that that's a great example of the rescue mission, of the capacity to unite, the capability, the potential for humanity to come together on a common issue and just make it happen, to actually, save lives. On something where there, like that particular situation where there are people stuck and needing help, it's like, great, there's nothing to argue about, make it happen. Unfortunately, with the situations of the climate, of militarism, the powers that be have given us a lot to argue about, and I think that that's been on purpose. I even look at the issues around the UN where, like Molly, you just said, that so like the majority of countries actually in the UN, you actually see that the majority of the world is usually on the same page. It's just that the majority of the world are outside of the UN Security Council, which is the most powerful nations who really call the shots because they can just veto everything. And especially with the US, going back to what I first started when in terms of that Israeli assault on Gaza, the UN almost overwhelmingly, like what would go by pass a resolution calling it illegal, calling it unjust what Israel is doing, and the US vetoed it, and that's all it took. So I think that it's a sign in the right direction that the UN, like, again, is like the majority of the UN countries are saying, yeah, we need action now. But the majority of the UN has been saying that for so long, and we have to do something so that the powers that be, in particular the US, fearing the other rising superpowers to steal its gains, are actually it's more afraid of its own people. And that I think that is what's going to happen, need to happen, if we're going to challenge the power it has in the UN Security Council and around the world.
So Molly called in, and you too can call in. We have less than 20 minutes left, so you might want to do it sooner rather than later. Don't wait till the last 5 minutes, please. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in and join the conversation with my guest, Cody Urban, with Resist U.S.-Led War Movement. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host of this Wednesday edition of Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And, so call in now and give us your thoughts, your feelings. Ask a question. So yeah, the idea of a global, I remember the lead up to what was called the Movement for Global Justice or Anti-Globalization Movement of the 1990s, leading up to the massive to-do at the World Trade Organization in Seattle in 1999, which then kind of blew out of the water with 9/11. Some people think, I have a tendency to a suspicion to think that it might be related, but who's ever going to know? It certainly was convenient for the global powers that be and the military contractors, etc., that movement kind of fell apart because of the war on terror and this huge focus. So often wars come about at these strange moments in history. Like, think of World War One. There's a massive international socialist movement arising up.
That comes out of a moment of crisis, too.
That actually threatened, or was perceived, the capitalists certainly thought it was a threat to their system. Mm-hmm. And, World War One came about, et cetera, et cetera. So, resisting U.S.-led war.
Yeah, and I actually think that that's something key we have to keep in mind, is that these moments of crisis will always bring out more and more resistance. You know, because when people start to see that their livelihoods, their ability to, I mean, just live in some cases, if we're talking about the most oppressed peoples around the world, we're talking about the working class, we're talking about peasants in predominantly rural, feudal, colonial countries.
If we're Central America, for example.
Central America. And I think a lot back to that first time I went to the Philippines. You know, again, if you want to talk about resistance to militarism, you know, I remember I was, those of us who went were given a presentation by LUMOD students. LUMOD is one of the indigenous peoples of Mindanao, which is the southernmost region of the Philippines. And so there was a LUMOD, there was a network of LUMOD schools that were operating at the time through the Department of Education. The Duterte regime eventually canceled the registration of all the LUMOD schools and actually threatened to bomb them if they didn't stop their organizing. And now under the new Marcos regime, I think that they face even more threats. But at the time, these students put on a play. They actually put on a theatrical presentation to show us what it was like to be driven from their school at gunpoint by the Philippine military that was holding rifles that were paid for by U.S. tax dollars, because all the military and police of the Philippines pretty much is armed by military aid from the U.S. And the reason they did that is because the Philippine government has been trying to allow a coal mine to be set up area where there's coal, nickel, copper in the rural Philippines. And, you know, that very, like, heartbreaking, but just also just incredibly inspiring presentation showed that not only was there this massive, like, violence that these students, these indigenous students, are facing every day they were learning ways to fight back, and they were learning ways to not be divided. You know, the military was actually trying to link with some of the indigenous leaders. And actually, one thing we learned was that, you know, the third time I was in the Philippines back in 2019, there was a tour of indigenous leaders, LUMOD leaders from the Philippines who were coming by the U.S. There was actually a tour in support of the government, and we found out when we were there that the government actually linked with false indigenous leaders to try to get contracts.
Ah, an old story.
Yeah. And so the people were actually uniting and saying, no, like, this is our voice. This is what we have to do. And we need to fight back against militarization and actually have the people in control of their lands. And I think that's where the support always has to be.
Indeed. We only have about a little over 10 minutes left. We do have another caller. And again, you can maybe get one more caller after Francis at 503-231-8187. Go ahead, Francis.
Hi. I agree that it will take the people to stop this corporate war machine. I hear you describe the oppression that is committed on the people to maintain short-term profits. And I hear the people resisting being dismissed as collateral damage. And I think it would actually be quite simple to remove the hold that the corporate war machine has on the governments of our countries. For us to say war is illegal, stop it, and start finding diplomatic ways to resolve conflicts. The wars that we're talking about right now seem to be about who who's got weapons where. That is the most ludicrous, absurd notion I've ever heard. And the people should tell our leaders to stop playing that game and to resolve that war is illegal and profiting from conflict resolution, violent conflict resolution, is illegal.
Okay.
We must find a way. We need to start thinking out of that paradigm. I heard a question, I'll be quiet in a second, but in the last presidential campaign, one of the questions from one of the narrators was, who do you perceive to be the United States' most dangerous enemy right now? Do you hear how absurd that question is? What are we doing looking for enemies?
Mm-hmm.
We're creating them over who's got what guns where. It's absurd.
Couldn't agree more.
You guys take care. Okay. Take care.
And I guess what I'll say to that is that something that we say is illegal has to be enforced. That's the way that the government, when the forces say something is illegal, you know, if someone does something that they say is illegal, they send the police, they send the military. We need a people's alternative to enforce what the majority of the people of the world are saying is illegal. And I think that's where organizing, building a mass movement, building an international united front of mass movements against war and militarism, that's something that like effectively demands that there's an end to this, that you know, can shut down business, that can shut down business as usual until the government realizes it has no other choice. That's the way that we enforce what the people say is illegal.
And we are winding down. My guest has been and will be for the next 10 minutes, Cody Urban with the Resist U.S.-led War Movement. I'd like to, you know, at the end, after we go to our next caller in a second here, that will be Len, how people can plug in, sort of what sort of things are going on locally, you know. Not all our listeners are here in the Portland, Columbia River Gorge, Willamette Valley area, but most of them are. But I do want to say, coming up next week, I'm going to try to make this more a regular thing as I get more. I'm kind of just on this this anti-militarization thing. It's going to be a dominant theme of this program going
as it should
forward. So last Monday, a week and a half ago, several U.S. veterans and their allies were arrested outside the nation's Capitol building on Wednesday as they protested the military's role in driving the climate crisis, from its massive greenhouse gas emissions to its large-scale release of toxic chemicals overseas, think burn pits. Veterans for Peace, a national anti-war group that organized a demonstration, said at least seven veterans and supporters were arrested. Okay, so I'm going to have at least a couple of those people on next week here, right here on Wednesday Talk Radio. So look forward to that. And before I give Cody the last word, let's hear what Lee has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
It's Len, not Lee.
Oh, Len, sorry.
No problem. So I think this is broadly on the same subject, but it's a pretty big change, but it's very time sensitive. And that is that August 22nd is a deadline for comments to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission about modifications to a big pipeline that runs through the middle of Oregon, where they would basically, these modifications are so they can pump way more frack gas through it. Okay, and for details, I recommend people check with the Columbia River Keeper, because they put on a very good webinar yesterday explaining lots of detail that I may have gotten up 10% of it in notes, and I'm not going to try to take time on it now. But as I say, the deadline is August 22nd, and I would just hope that people would look at that, because as far as, you know, I'm kind of focusing the opposite of the guest in that I'm trying to drill down, do local stuff, because, you know, I've tried to do the big stuff for years, and you know, I'm behind you all the way.
Right on.
Anyway, this is something we can do right here in Oregon. That
okay, I think maybe
cut down on the increase.
Yeah, I think maybe Barbara Bernstein talked about that on Monday. I'm not sure. I just saw the headline for a show. I didn't hear it. But so go to Columbia River Keeper. I'm sure there are other sources. If you look up the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, August 22 deadline for a pipeline, a frac gas pipeline. Anyway, thank you, Len, for that. That's a timely reminder coming up soon. So, Cody, so what's going on locally? How can people plug in? This seems there's like a lot of excitement around this among some people. How can we spread that excitement?
Yeah, totally. So a few things that I'll just lay out. So locally, I said that globally, resist U.S.-led war. We have this campaign, Cut Ties with War Profiteers. There is a very local campaign along the same lines that Portland State University students are taking up to try to end PSU's relationships with Boeing. Boeing actually has a very tight relationship with the School of Business. There is an internship that they use to try to funnel students into management at Boeing making these weapons of war. And so there's a petition that these students have up. And if you listeners go to tinyurl.com/cutTiesBoeing, you can find their petition to the administration to end PSU's relationship with Boeing.
I will attempt to add that to my program page. That's something I
perfect.
Kind of forgot about in advance. But go ahead.
Yeah, and then just a couple events coming up. One is has a date already, and that's this Sunday. There's actually going to be a rally to honor the people who have been murdered in Gaza and to call for an immediate end to the Israeli occupation and war against the Palestinian people. And so it's this Sunday, the 14th at 7 p.m. in front of the Salmon Springs Fountain. And listeners can go to the social media of SUPER, that's Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights at PSU, to get more in touch with that. And then finally, there's not a date set for something yet, but around the U.S., different Filipino and organizations and other organizations in solidarity with the people of the Philippines are getting ready actually for September 20th, where the just recently elected president, many people are really trying to point to the facts that this previous election was stolen in very many ways, but the President Marcos Jr., the son of the former U.S.-backed dictator Ferdinand Marcos, will actually be visiting the U.N., will be visiting the U.S. on September 20th. And that's a very significant date because September 21st is the 50th anniversary of when Marcos's father declared martial law throughout the Philippines and used, again, U.S.-provided weaponry to decimate people's organizations and create an iron-fisted rule. And so the fact that Marcos is visiting on this day is huge. And listeners can follow Bayn, that's B-A-Y-N, Portland, as well as the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines. And please follow these organizations and be on the lookout for local actions to contribute to
this. It's great. After you got that, I realize we're really running out of time. But I want to throw out a huge question that would take an hour to answer. But you know, we've got this. You know, there's a January 6th attempted insurrection at the Capitol. We've got this massive right wing resurgence based on this delusionary thinking, which has run very strongly through this country. It's not new, but it's really taken hold. The sort of retrenchment of the sort of white nationalist, sort of like this anti-multicultural hardcore, and it's heading in a bad direction. And so, you know, we've got this Democratic administration that's supposedly holding the line on democracy. At the same time, it's just carrying on the same power games it ever has. If there's a deep state, it's the Pentagon. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, again, it's like the Republicans and the Democrats, they're just different sides, two sides of the same coin when it comes to the ruling class politics in the U.S. I mean, both of them have directed the Pentagon to do just horrendous attacks around the world. I mean, just look at the war on terror. Even it was started by Bush, but under Obama, it created a it had a list of like endless assassinations across the world that became like just an administrative war is almost something I think of, because you just click off a name here and there, and you know, throughout Trump and now Biden, whether it's red or blue, it just ticks back and forth the party, but it keeps the war going.
At the same time, we do seem to be losing whatever facade or remnants of democracy that we have, and so it's gonna be a tough battle. I can't even let you answer that, because I think we are flush out of time.
We'll let the people answer it in the days to come.
All right. Cody Urban with the Resist U.S.-Led War Movement. Check out our program page and all that else that you can find at our website at kboo.fm. Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks, Cody.
Thank you so much, Paul.
You slick, you investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you a globalized curse, you put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse, and that's how it's done, war after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language, you creeps of disguise. Yeah, disinformation. It's like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers, you gambler thieves, you profit on war. You think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done. Time after time, country after country, and crime after crime. You pretend it's religion.